That's right.
So, good morning. It's going to be, in some sense, more of the same, but from a slightly different perspective. So it's all going to be about precision weighting of prediction errors, and its relevance to computational psychiatry. So that second part, you've almost already seen most of it. So you've seen much of the relevance to computational psychiatry of precision weighting of prediction errors. But we'll now build this up from the very simplest beginnings. And to do that, we'll get right into a shamelessly artificial exam. Imagine the following situation. You're on a boat, you're in a storm, and you've lost all your modern equipment. All you can do to find out where you are is to measure the angle between north and a lighthouse that you see on the horizon. But you only see it intermittently. You can only see it when you're at the top of the wave, and when you're down in the trough, it disappears. Now, these are the measurements you make: 76, 73, 75, 72, 77. At some point, you're going to have to do your calculation. So, how are you going to do that? What number out of these, or what number derived from these, are you going to use to do your calculation? I heard the mean. Right, the mean. That's 74.6. So how do you calculate your mean? How do you go about calculating that? Question is as simple as it sounds. So the answer you usually get is you just sum them up and divide them by how many there are. There are five, so you divide them by five. But it turns out there's a simpler, in certain situations, way to do it that doesn't require you to remember all of the numbers you've observed. And in situations where your measurements, your observations, come in sequentially, that's more efficient. So, after some algebra, we get... That should be a bar on the X. Somehow I cannot get PowerPoint to display that correctly. I think the upper one is okay, but... So, here, where's the mouse? Here. These should be bars on the X's, huh? You get this update. And all this requires you to remember is your previous mean and the number of observations you've made, and then you can insert your current observation here, and you get the new mean. This is the proof. You can take a picture of it, study it at home. So, graphically, our first observation is 76. That's our first mean, also 76. Now, the next observation is 73. So, the mean moves to the middle of these by our update formula. Next observation, 75, that only moves it slightly to the right. Next observation, 72, that's going to move far to the left, right? Well, a little, but not that much. And then the last observation, 77, only a little to the right, even though 77 was far away to the right. And the reason for that, of course, is that with every new observation, the weight that is placed on the difference between the observation and the previous mean is reduced. We have a 1 over n law here. So this is going to turn out to be of fundamental importance, so let's look at it in a bit more detail. What are the building blocks we have here? So one important building block is the prediction. That's our previous belief before we make the next observation. Then there is the new observation. And the difference between the new observation and the prediction is the prediction error. And this prediction error is multiplied or weighted by a certain number that can be interpreted as the learning rate. So these are the building blocks that we're going to see again and again in updates of all types. So where is the uncertainty in here? Because that was one of the topics of the talk. So how do we deal with uncertainty? How do we adjust our brains to use an appropriate level of uncertainty? Where's the uncertainty? Anybody? Here in the update? Where does that come in? What quantifies the level of uncertainty? That is the prediction error. That's not the answer I was looking for. I was looking for the other element in the update, which would be the weight on the prediction error. So we have to weight our prediction errors according to the uncertainty that we're in. So before we've made any observations, on our first observation, the learning rate here is 1 because we have total uncertainty. But the more observations we make, the less uncertainty we have. And the more certain we are that we already know what the right angle between north and the lighthouse is, the lower we're going to weight the prediction error on new observations. So this captures our uncertainty, the learning rate here. And this is the weight on the prediction error. So, yeah, the less we know, the higher the learning rate. Now, this is a simple, extremely primitive example where we just update the mean of a series of observations. But as we've heard in the previous talk, the brain is a Bayesian brain. And does this pattern generalize to Bayesian inference? Where by Bayesian inference, we simply mean inference on uncertain quantities according to the rules of probability theory. And that simply means according to logic. So agents who use Bayesian inference, and that's one of the reasons we believe that the brain is Bayesian, because agents will make better predictions, and that'll give them an evolutionary advantage. So we may assume that evolved biological agents use something like Bayesian inference. They have to be fast, of course, too, because if you're still doing Bayesian inference while the other agent is already eating you, then that's not optimal anymore. So the question is, is Bayesian inference also based on predictions that are updated using uncertainty-weighted prediction errors? And you've already guessed it, the answer is yes. So let's look at the same example again in terms of Bayesian inference. Now, when we do Bayesian inference, something we always need is a prior. So our prior belief on the true angle is captured by a Gaussian here. This Gaussian has a mean, mu of theta, theta is the angle, and a precision, which is simply the inverse of the variance. And now, to keep it simple, the likelihood of our observation is also Gaussian. So we say we have an observation precision of pi epsilon, and that enters the likelihood Gaussian here. And if the true angle is theta, then our observation x is going to be distributed as a Gaussian around that true theta, because we have some observation noise, which is characterized by this precision pi epsilon. Now, Bayes' rule tells us how to update our prior into a posterior. This is Bayes' rule, and this has already been solved. And what we find is that if the prior is Gaussian, And the likelihood is Gaussian that the posterior will also be Gaussian. So our updated belief is also Gaussian. But now we have a new mean and a new precision. So the question is, what exactly are those new quantities? What is the new mean and what is the new precision? And this is how these updates look like, or what they look like. The precision is simply the sum of the precisions of prior and likelihood. That's the posterior precision. And the mean is updated according to a familiar pattern. So we have the prior mean, and we have the prediction error here. New observation minus prior mean. This gives us the prediction error here, and this is weighted by a ratio of precisions that we can again interpret as a learning rate. It's a precision-weighted prediction error again. And the size of the update is proportional to the likelihood precision and inversely proportional to the posterior precision. And this makes eminent sense because, again, if you already believe you know what the true answer is, that means if your posterior precision is very high, you're not going to be impressed very much by your prediction error. But it depends also on the precision of your observation. Because if I expect my observation to be here, and it turns out to be here, is that a lot? Was I off by a lot? I thought it would be here, but it was here.
It depends.
It depends, yes. What does it depend on?
The variability of the signal.
Yes. My likelihood precision, the precision of my observation, exactly. So if my likelihood precision, my observation precision, is very narrow, so I have a very high precision, so this characterizes my observation, my likelihood distribution, and the observation is over here, that means a lot. But if my observation precision is very flat, if I basically think, well, I'm sort of seeing this through the fog and the mist, and I can't make very precise observations, then it doesn't mean as much if my observation is off by a lot. So we have this weighting according to the observation precision in the numerator. And we can summarize our learning rate by how much we're learning here divided by how much we already know. Now it turns out, I will not go into this in any more detailed fashion, but it turns out one can prove that this pattern is not specific to the univariate Gaussian case, but it generalizes to Bayesian updates for all exponential families of likelihood distributions with conjugate priors, and that encompasses all formal descriptions of inference you're ever likely to need. But there remains the question, does inference as we've described it adequately describe the situation of actual biological agents? Or is there anything missing? I'll give you the answer to that. Yes, something is missing. So what is missing? Let's first look at our agent. So this is our agent. On the left is sort of its inside, and on the right it's outside. The agent receives sensory input, infers on the hidden states of the environment, based on that sensory input, and acts accordingly in the sense of based on its beliefs about the hidden states of the environment, which remain hidden to it. There's no direct access to them, only through the sensory input. Is the agent able to infer on the world out there? So, what's missing from the description of inference that we've used? You can think about the example we had about the boat out at sea, trying to find the shore. What happens there?
Actions.
Yes, I'm moving my boat. But even if I didn't act, the boat would be moving. So, observations I made 2 minutes ago shouldn't have the same weight as observations I made 10 seconds ago. So, in a changing world, in a dynamic world, we're going to have to take account of the dynamics in the modeling. And in everything we've done up to now, the dynamics have been missing. So how do we put them in there? So the main problem in the modeling that we had up to now is that as information accumulates, our learning rate decreases. So we have to find a mechanism to keep it high enough and at just the right level for how fast the world is changing. The faster the world changes, the higher our learning rate will have to be. The more slowly it changes, the lower it can be. Because then we don't want to throw away old information as much. So there's always going to be an optimal level for the learning rate. But how do we find that? Now, let's first think about a very simple way to keep the learning rate from going too low. What is the simplest way? If we just think about this mean updating where we have the 1 over n rule, what is the simplest way to get that not to go low?
Get rid of the
1 over n, absolutely, and replace it by... That would be extreme, because that would mean throwing away all previous knowledge. That would mean adjusting your belief to your last observation totally. There's a slightly less... Yeah?
1 over?
Square root of n. But, yeah, that would go down even more quickly.
Just limit the end.
Just limit the end, yeah, keep it constant. So, I acknowledge that setting it to 1 is one way of keeping it constant, but it's a slightly radical way of keeping it constant. So, if we take the update equation again and just replace it by some alpha, then alpha can be 1. But it can be any other number between 0 and 1. If we keep it at 0, then no update takes place, and we just stubbornly hold fast to our first belief. So if we replace 1 over n by alpha, this is usually called Riscola-Wagner learning, and this has been around since 1972, but I'd like to mention that Riscola-Wagner had more sort of had other reasons to come up with this kind of learning. But it's been extremely successful, despite its simplicity. So, and it's in great use to this day. So, using alpha means only taking account of the last 1 over alpha assumptions. So if I take an alpha of 1/5, that means implicitly only taking account of the last 5 observations. Yeah. But the problem remains. How do we know that alpha reflects the right level of uncertainty at any one time? And second, how do we account for changes in uncertainty? Because sometimes the world will be changing more quickly and sometimes less quickly. So a constant alpha will only by chance be appropriate in any given situation. So what we really need is an adaptive learning rate that accurately reflects uncertainty. There have been many efforts, and before I go into these efforts to come up with such an adaptive learning rate, I'll just quickly give you a possible taxonomy of uncertainty. So there are also several of these out there. But one of them is that there is outcome uncertainty, just to take apart the different kinds of uncertainty that we have to deal with. And this is the uncertainty that remains unaccounted for by the model. This is called risk by economists. And this uncertainty remains even when we know all parameters exactly. For instance, when we flip a coin, we expect an outcome probability of 1/2 for both heads and tails. So we know the parameter in the Bernoulli distribution to be 1/2. And nonetheless, the uncertainty about whether it'll be heads or tails remains. So this is outcome uncertainty. Then there is informational, or sometimes called expected uncertainty, about the value of these model parameters. So if I'm at a one-armed bandit, and I don't know what the probability is that I'll get a win, then I'm in a different situation from flipping a coin, because I have informational uncertainty on top of the outcome uncertainty. Then a third kind of uncertainty is environmental or unexpected uncertainty, and this is due to changes in model parameters that are not accounted for in our Bayesian example, and that's why they're sometimes called unexpected. So the various efforts that have been made, so this is not an exhaustive list, but it's some of the some examples of efforts to do that. I want to mention especially the Kalman filter. This is the most famous. This is ideal for or optimal for linear dynamical systems, but has the disadvantage that realistic data, the world is non-linear, and that's why it has to be fine-tuned, and even if it's fine-tuned, it often falls on its nose when it's fed with data that comes from a non-linear source. So, I'm going to surprise you by focusing on this effort here in what remains. And this is based on a generic non-linear hierarchical Bayesian model, and that allows us to derive update equations that are optimal in the sense that they minimize surprise based on a judgment about the currently operational uncertainty in the environment. The basic idea is very, very simple. You have a hierarchy of Gaussian random walks. Our quantity of interest x1 is here at the bottom of the hierarchy, and we say x1 is distributed as a Gaussian around x1 at the previous time point k minus 1. And the variance of this Gaussian, the width of the distribution, is a function of the next higher level in the hierarchy. And there the same thing happens again. The next higher level is x2. Now x2 at time k is distributed as a Gaussian around x2 at time k minus 1. And the variance of that Gaussian is a function of x3 and so on up to xn, where we assume the variance to be constant at theta. So, just to give you the update at the bottom of the hierarchy, this is where the input comes in. U is the input, x1 is our quantity of interest, and pi hat u is our observation precision. This now takes the place of pi epsilon from the Gaussian model. And this gives us the following updates for our beliefs. So now the precision is updated here. So it's learned at each time point after each observation. So I think that relates also to your question after Carl's talk. This is how we learn the precision. And then the update for the mean is simply our precision-weighted prediction error again. So if we unpack the learning rate, which was here in the mean update, the weight on the prediction error, we see, at first we see nothing but symbols, but then I point out to you the outcome uncertainty. So the first kind of uncertainty we had, pi hat u. This is the observation precision. It appears twice here. Then the informational uncertainty, sigma 1. This is the variance of our probability distribution on x1, and this is simply the uncertainty we have about x1 at this time. So we have the informational uncertainty in there. And then we have the environmental uncertainty, which depends on the next higher level in the hierarchy. You can see this depends on mu 2, so on our belief about what the second level is doing. So we have all three kinds of uncertainty in here. Now, as a practical example of how this model deals with uncertainty and uses precision weighting to update its belief, I'm showing you a time series of exchange rates between the Swiss franc, and the US dollar. So this is the worth of the US dollar expressed in francs during 2010 and much of 2011. So more than 600 trading days. These are the daily closing rates. And you see, if you look at the second level, x2, there are two jumps in the uncertainty amount, x1. And it turns out those are two events where the view of the market on currencies change. This is in about April 2010, when the market suddenly discovered that Greece was broke. Keeps rediscovering that. And this is in September 2011, when the Swiss National Bank said, we're going to put a floor under how far the euro can fall against the franc. So at that point, the euro and franc exchange rate went flat, but of course they both still fluctuated against the dollar, and you can see this change here, if I get the mouse here, this change in the volatility here shooting up. And even at the next higher level, you can see these little blips here. Now, if we look at the precision weights in the same time series, this is now just the precision weighting going on in filtering this time series, you can see these two events even more starkly. At the second level, the precision weight shoots up when something interesting happens. So you can see how such a filtering model deals with changes in the environment and in the volatility basically automatically, because we derive these update equations by variational inversion of the generative model that we employ. So there are two kinds of precision errors. One of them is the VAPES. Those are the value prediction errors. That's just of the kind that we normally think about. That's just my prediction is here and the outcome is here. That's a value prediction error. Now the second kind are the VOPs. Those are the volatility prediction errors, and those are the ones that we use to update our beliefs about precisions. So a volatility prediction error is built slightly differently from a value prediction error. I'm not going to walk you through these equations. I just wanted to mention this, but this is the mechanism by which we can learn the appropriate level of volatility in the environment and the appropriate learning rate that derives from this. So one of the simplest HDF models that we've been using, this has basically been our workhorse, is the three-level HDF for binary observations. There have been many papers using that, and this is driven by a VAPE between the second and the first levels, and by a VOPE between the third and the second levels. The notation here just is like this, if you're familiar with the traditional notation for Bayesian models, then this is defined as a constant, and a hexagon contains a state that changes with time, it has a time index, and it depends on its own previous state. A diamond is the same as the plate notation, so it has a time index, a diamond, but it doesn't depend on its own previous state, so it only depends on the arrows going into it. And, for example, here we have a hexagon influencing a diamond, and that means the hexagon depends on its own previous state and the diamond doesn't. But they both move in time. So if we could look at the learning rate here, this is real data fitted by and collected by Andreea Diaconescu. So she fitted this data using a Ruskola-Wagner learning rate, which was constant here. You can see this in light blue, I hope. Yeah, it's well visible. And here is the HGF learning rate in dashed red, going up and down appropriately as the environment changes. So this is the ground truth probability that the subject has to infer. Starts out at 0.8, goes down to 0.5, down to 0.2, and jumps up and down, back and forth. And we see these spikes in the learning rate whenever something interesting happens. And this is as it should be. So in general, the HGF learning rate is lower than the Ruskola-Wagner learning rate, but at sort of crisis times, it shoots up so that the agent can quickly adapt to the new environment that it's now in. And as soon as it's found out that the new environment is not changing anymore, the learning rate decreases. And this brown dashed line here is the learning rate at the third level, which you can also see fluctuating in response to volatility changes. So the three-level HGF for continuous observations, this is the one that we used for the financial time series modeling. This is driven by a VAPE at the lowest level and by VOPES at the higher level. And again, this is what gives you this here. So these are the VOPES that are weighted by these precision weights where you can pick up the changes in the environment, sort of the change point detection that you get for free. And you can modularly extend such HGF models. So this is a model currently in use by Giles here, using variable drift. And here you can also place VAPE and VOPE labels at the arrows. So here we now have two VAPEs and two VOPEs. And this means that we have a drift in our time series that we are modeling with it. Sometimes it's drifting upwards, sometimes it's drifting downwards. And this VAPE here first tries to just explain everything by a change in level, and whatever cannot be explained by a change in level for our quantity of interest will have to be explained by drift. So there's a second VAPE going over there, and both of these have a VOPE hierarchy on top of them. Another modular extension that you can do in a very simple task where the subject just had to predict the next input and was told this input, which is depicted in green here, so the green dots are the inputs to the subject, is drawn from a Gaussian distribution, and the subject will just have to predict the next input. But either the mean or the variance of the Gaussian can jump at any time. You can see here the variance is very low, then it jumps up. And here the mean jumps, but the variance stays the same, and then the mean stays the same up to here, but the variance jumps up here, and so on. So various jumps in variance and mean. And here you have an HGF model modeling the variance and the mean separately. So the X hierarchy is about the mean and the alpha hierarchy is about the variance. And the two VAPEs driving this at the bottom and the two VOPEs at the top, taking care of the changes in volatility. And this is what the fit looks like. This is a subject that's pretty well able to estimate the level of noise in the environment here. This is the ground truth in the dashed line and the subject's inferred belief in the red line. Then, empirical evidence. We have a very large study by Sandra Iglesias. She tested about 150 subjects. So in three studies, one behavioral and two fMRI. And in all of these studies independently, the HGF, the full three-level HGF, won out against sort of truncated variants of the HGF and against the variable learning rate model by Sutton and against the old Ruskolova. Now, the question is, does the brain actually do its updating that way? And the full answer is, we don't really know yet, but we're accumulating evidence to the effect that that might actually be true. So these are the activations that you get in these two fMRI studies that we saw. So these are this is the first study, this is the second study, and this is the conjunction of the two studies. In response to the precision weighted prediction error at the second level in the HGF. And you can see very strong activations here. This is all whole brain corrected. And this is an indication that even though this is an abstract model-derived quantity, the precision-weighted prediction error at the second level, that the brain actually cares about something like that. You get activations in the brainstem. So again, across two studies, the red bits are whole brain corrected and the yellow bits when a mask is applied. And here you get the conjunction. And even higher in the hierarchy, you have the precision-weighted prediction error at the third level. And there you can see activations in the basal forebrain in areas usually associated with acetylcholine. And again, across two studies, replicated and conjunction, whole brain corrected. If you want to use models like that, you can download the HGF toolbox from translationalneuromodeling.org/tapas. It's part of the Tapas software collection. The collection is called Tapas because it's pieces of totally unrelated software. One of those pieces is the HGF toolbox. There's an interactive demo and manual, and if you don't find what you're looking for in the toolbox, but would like to have a modular extensible framework and optimization algorithms and stuff like that, then you can just drop in your own model. It's fairly easy to do because it's modular and extensible. It's based on MATLAB. So now, why is this important for computational psychiatry? I won't have to say much about that because Carl has already told you. So it's all about precision weighting. There has been a host of papers on this. We've already seen the computational anatomy of psychosis by Rick, Bayesian account of hysteria, free energy and illusions, active inference, sensory attenuation and illusions, an aberrant precision account of autism by Becky Lawson, whom you'll hear speak later, and another account of autism involving oxytocin very much this time. And you've already seen this too. So Carl has explained this in detail. And I'm sure you all remember the details of everything going on here. And here. Let me just draw your attention to the main bit, which is the precision weighted prediction errors, which also appear here in these continuous time generalized filtering models. So here we have the precision, here in capital, the pi, and then the prediction minus, the observation minus the prediction. Overweighting of sensory evidence, we've had that. So there are two ways in which the posterior belief can be pulled or pushed towards the sensory evidence. First, by increased sensory precision, and second, by decreased prior precision. And this is what the second one is, what underlay the simulation here that produced the behavior also seen in schizophrenic subjects. So, failure of input attenuation, further examples, the force matching illusion, we've also seen that, the corn sweet effect, and the hollow mask illusion. So, I think we have the time to... Who is familiar with the hollow mask illusion? Show of hands. Okay, that's maybe half, but the other half isn't. So this is something you must have seen, because it's so spectacular. I hope we have sound. Do we have sound?
Very quiet. I got this little example of a sort of optical illusion here. So if you photograph it in the right way, as you're about to see, the eye plays extraordinary tricks on you. So there it is Einstein. There he is in profile. Wow. And there's the inverted bit, but hello. Your eye tells you that's poking outwards, and yet it isn't. That's the inside bit. And your eye refuses to believe it until you get to that.
Oh, you're twisting my melon, man.
Isn't that
Why does it do that?
Well, it does that because your brain is programmed to recognize human faces, and it's one of the first things babies do is look at faces, and you expect to see a face, and even though you know it isn't a real face, your brain fills in the
idea again.
It's an astonishing
thing. Stephen, does it only work with Einstein? Only work with another man?
It would work with any human. It's amazing, isn't it?
But it's done it. I can't believe it did the same trick twice. Yes.
I know, the point is...
No, listen, we're not going to fall for it this time. Yes. Three times on the
outside, outside. This is going to be inside, Lee.
Inside.
We literally filmed this. I mean, you can see that's all it is.
This is a great trick. I might cut my head in half and scoop out my brain.
That's a wonderful thing. It would make the most wonderful blancmange or something, wouldn't it?
Are we going to bother with the rest of the show? Because I could happily just...
Watch it.
It's lovely chatting and everything, and I love what we do, but let's just...
You're hypnotised.
Have you got any others about
that? No, I do what we can do. We can make the Queen happy or sad.
Oh.
We've got a £5 note. You can do this with your own £5 notes, but...
Okay. So, it's almost unbelievable that some people actually see the mask the way it is. So, when they see it from behind... They see it as the hollow mask it is, even though most of us, maybe all of us here, cannot help ourselves seeing a face coming out towards us. And now the fascinating thing is that this is one of the things that we can explain by attenuation of sensory input. So if we have a failure of sensory attenuation, we will stick to what exactly we see without involving our top-down priors very much. But we've looked at faces for so long, we have such strong priors about how they look, that we've reached a point where we cannot help ourselves involving our priors in what we see. But that doesn't apply to everybody. And that has consequences in later up in the hierarchy, so that it's hard for people who are so close to their sensory input to build an accurate hierarchical model of how the world really works. Then I already briefly mentioned the attenuation of interoceptive signals in autism. I guess Becky will speak about that a bit. So in summary, We have to make good predictions to avoid surprise and survive, so we have to use probabilistic, so Bayesian inference based on a good model of the environment. Bayesian inference means updating beliefs by uncertainty, so precision-weighted prediction errors in a very general sense. So almost all of Bayesian inference can be reduced to that. And precision weighting has to take account of all forms of uncertainty, and a breakdown in this may be the root, at the root of many psychopathological phenomena. Thank you for listening.
Thank you very much, Christoph. Very clear. Any questions? We've got a few minutes, so...
Yep.